Coming up on The Boo at 11:30, it's Madness Radio. We'll meet Gogo Ikaya Asima, a Sangoma healer in the Zulu tradition of South Africa. And now stay tuned for Health Watch, a look at the new documentary Unrest about the mysterious illness known as chronic fatigue syndrome. Director Jennifer Brea will premiere the film in Portland on October 4 at the Hollywood Theater at 7 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of CORT, October 1st through the 29th at the Artist Repertory Theater in Portland. CORT is an installation of visual art and live theater inspired by playwright Lin Bo's own experience of being arrested and detained by the Chinese government. CORT explores the murky intersection of fact and fiction in the crafting of art and news. Again, that's CORT, October 1st to the 29th at the Artist Repertory Theater, 1515 Southwest Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Ellen Goldsmith, licensed acupuncturist, your host. Today we are speaking with Jennifer Brea, director of the film Unrest, recently released in theaters throughout the United States and to be released in the UK later this month. Jennifer Brea herself suffers from ME, CFS, myalgic encephalomyelitis, otherwise known as chronic fatigue syndrome. Her film is described as a personal documentary and follows the story of her and her husband Omar as this asteroid of illness hits her and their lives. She first turns the camera on herself as a personal diary and then from her bed connects with others throughout the world suffering with ME/CFS, and the diary becomes a documentary. I saw Unrest this past week. It is raw, deeply emotional, heartbreaking, and inspiring. It has been described by the New York Times as a film that insists on giving a voice to victims whose greatest challenge, apart from their symptoms, is surmounting a world of indifference. Unrest will be shown in Portland this Wednesday, October 4th, at the Hollywood Theater at 7 p.m., with a live Q&A with Jennifer Brea via Skype directly after the screening, and I encourage you to go see it. Jennifer Brea, congratulations on your film, and welcome to Health Watch.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really glad you're on today. And it was interesting this morning on NPR. It was the first time I'd ever heard them speak of ME/CFS. So maybe your film is rippling out there.
That's really good to hear. I hope so.
Yeah. So I wondered if you just would share with our listeners what ME/CFS is and how you first, how it first hit you.
So ME is a really serious chronic illness that completely changed my life. And I know a lot more about it now, but at the beginning, it appeared as essentially after an infection. So I, my husband and I both got sick with a virus, and he recovered and I didn't. And after a high fever, I started to notice strange neurological symptoms that would kind of come and go. And over the course of a year, had infection after infection after infection. And I went to my doctor and said, you know, I think something is wrong with my immune system, because every time I get a cold or, a sore throat, something really simple, I end up totally crashed in bed for days and sometimes weeks. And at that time, because my lab results kept coming back normal, I was told again and again that everything was fine and that I wasn't really sick. Until eventually, over time, I got worse and worse and became bedridden. And I think a part of the reason that I did get worse was because I wasn't able to manage the disease properly in those early days. and kind of came to find that the core symptom of the disease is this thing called post-exertional malaise. And that's the sort of dynamic where, you know, wherever we are on the spectrum, we have a certain amount of energy, of kind of capacity, and if you go past what that those limits are, you quote crash and end up, you know, in some cases I might end up being able to go from walking to, you know, collapsing on the floor and not even being able to lift my head.
And you said it is a spectrum. There are people who live with it and are semi-functional, correct?
Yeah, so it's definitely a spectrum illness, like a lot of autoimmune diseases are. And so we don't know if this is an autoimmune disease, but it seems to affect people in different ways. So at the mild end of the spectrum, you might still be able to work, but you might spend, you know, your evenings and weekends at home or in bed in order for you to be able to recover and kind of make it back to work on the next Monday. And at the very severe end of the spectrum, there are patients who are completely bedridden 24 hours a day and have to live in dark rooms, unable to tolerate light, sound, or touch. So it is a quite wide spectrum. 75% of patients who have this disease can't work, and 25% are homebound or bedridden. And I think the thing that's deceptive is that you can actually encounter somebody who has this, who you might think is mild, who you might think is kind of functioning okay, and that's because when we're well enough to be out in the world, oftentimes we can look totally normal, and it's because we're operating within those limits of our kind of metabolic and energetic capacities. But then as soon as we go past those limits, we crash, and then you don't see us because we're at home. And that's really what the film is trying to do. It's trying to bring audiences inside of our homes and bedrooms in those moments and in those spaces that most people don't get to see.
And it does it very, very powerfully. I mean, it's something to be with you and the four families that you follow in this really painful and isolating journey. I mean, how is this, you know, this, you really chronicle it in the film that this disease has flown under the radar for decades. Could you talk a little bit about that?
So I think it goes back to sort of that dynamic I was talking about, you know, where there's a whole part of the population of patients who are homebound and bedridden. And that's probably about 250,000 people in this country. And so they, you know, very rarely are even well enough and able enough to leave their homes and go and see a doctor. And so these are patients that don't participate in medical studies and literally aren't seen by the system, as well as the fact that the disease can be so variable and is deceptive in that way. So I think that's been a part of the invisibility. I also think the other issue is that because there's been almost no federal funding for research over the course of decades, it's meant that we haven't been able to develop a scientific literature of the sort of scale, breadth, depth that we really need to in order to, you know, develop testing and sort of translational medicine that would actually get into doctors' offices and allow doctors to be able to properly diagnose and treat patients. And so I think there's been a kind of systemic institutional neglect on the research and the medical education side. And I think finally, there's just a sort of stigma that was really exacerbated by this name that, you know, they came up with in the 1980s of chronic fatigue syndrome. And, you know, the challenge is that fatigue feels like something that, you know, maybe all of us get from time to time if we, you know, are overworked or a little stressed out. And the fatigue is a qualitatively different thing from, you know, what it is to have a disease that affects your mitochondrial function and is really kind of hamstringing your body's ability to function at a metabolic level. And so we know now that patients with this disease have a wide variety of symptoms that are caused by epigenetic changes and inflammatory responses to exertion and to exercise, which is just a very different thing from being fatigued, which you can find, you know, in many different illnesses.
Right. So you're really talking about the distinction, and you've said this a number of times, you know, of this, when you exert yourself and go past that limit, that you then crash, but not just crash, you are, you, like you said, you can be bedridden. you know, it was noticeable in the film when you went out with your husband to some event, I think it was in Princeton, and you were cheering and you were so enthusiastic, and then you just crashed. I mean, so much so, you said your brain was burning, your body was burning, and you just couldn't function after that.
Well, and that's the coolest part of this disease, because I think, you know, all of us want to live, right? And all of us want to be able to have experiences and be out in the world. And this, you know, I've described this disease as a perfect custom prison, because it doesn't matter what you used to do, it takes away your ability to do it. So if you were, you know, an avid mountain climber, you can't do that anymore. If you were a mathematician, you don't have the cognitive function to do that anymore, the stamina. If you were a mother, you can't mother in the way that you used to. And so it's sort of, you know, universally disabling in that way. And then that scene in the film, you know, I think I was at my college reunion, and I was so excited to be there and so excited to see these friends that I hadn't seen in a very long time. And I felt well. I felt pretty well when I got there and kind of got caught up in the moment, not understanding what being in a crowd, what the sort of sound sensitivity I had would mean for me on a day like that, kind of showing up at a parade. And I think, you know, that's been the hardest thing to deal with this illness, is wanting to sometimes just get caught up in the moment and have that freedom of living, you know, whenever I do that, whenever I forget that I'm sick, I ultimately end up paying for it.
Mm. How has this disease changed you? Besides that, I mean, losing, you know, this ability to just function every day, but I'm just curious, you know, you take us on such a journey, and it must have some fundamental impact deep inside.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a really long process of grieving my old life and the life that I used to have and the one that I thought I would live. And I think the thing that's really hard about living with a chronic illness is that grieving's never done, because it's not like, okay, I have this thing that happened and then I recover from the trauma and then I move on. I think you keep getting re-traumatized as you move through life. And there are new things that you thought would happen at a certain phase. So, you know, you get sick when you're 14 and then you don't get to graduate high school on time, but then maybe you do, and then you go to college and then you miss out, but you don't finish. And then you see your friends move on and then they get married and then they have kids, you know, and I think there's a way in which at every stage of life you have to kind of confront where you are, and that makes it really, really hard. But I also think that over time, I've come to find a certain peace about it, and that really comes from being able to do this work, to be a filmmaker, to be an artist, to be an activist, and to feel like I'm fighting for something that's so much bigger than myself, in terms of this community of people that are millions strong. You know, we are legion, we are invisible, and to be fighting for all of our futures. I think that has given my life a profound meaning, that it's given me back some of the meaning that I lost when this disease took everything away from me. And I think it's really been understanding that I'm not alone and that there are others who share my experience, and just having that faith that if we come together, we can create a better future for ourselves, that we have it in us, within us and within our community to do that.
So now that this is coming to light and you really are bringing this disease into the public sphere in a new way, what's going on in terms of research and treatment at this point? Do you know?
So there's been an incredible, sort of resurgence of interest in the disease, and we have some amazing groups now at Stanford, UC San Diego, Columbia, Cornell, Harvard, and many other institutions around the country and the world, all starting to engage and research the disease. The main challenge, as I spoke to before, is that the funding is far too slow and far too little, and so it been difficult, I think, to really make the progress at scale and see that we need to change people's lives right now, which is what we're fighting for. But the research is finding new evidence in terms of abnormalities in this disease in, you know, brain imaging and mitochondrial function. So, you know, we know now that there seems to be certain specific parts of the energy of energy metabolism in those chemical pathways that are not functioning properly in this disease. And we don't know why. It could be due to autoimmunity, or it could be due to other reasons, but we're starting to kind of get a handle on those mechanisms. And that's really exciting because it, I think, is going to eventually lead to a commercial lab test. So the core problem is that we can measure many abnormalities in a research lab, but it's harder to do that in, you know, your standard kind of commercial lab test in a conventional doctor's office. So I think that's coming soon. And once we have that clear biomarker, it will help tremendously in terms of getting patients the right diagnosis and eventually connecting them to treatments. But we've known for a really long time that this is a disease that often starts after an infection, affects the immune system, affects the energy production, you know, sort of systems in the body. And so I'm very hopeful by the new interest. At the same time, I think we've known that this is a, quote, real disease for 50 years. And the science has been there. The science has been there for a long time. So I do think that it's really about changing public and medical conceptions, getting the education out there, and developing a consensus that this needs to be taken seriously and with some urgency.
So, you know, if the hope is focused on the Western medical approach to this illness, where are you seeing also the hope that lies outside this conventional approach to helping people with this very complex and elusive type of illness that could include other approaches such as, you know, diet, nutrition, you know, systemic approaches that are well-founded and practiced for thousands of years, hundreds of years, that can also support ME and CFS patients?
So that's a really hard question to answer, and it's a complicated one. So I would start by saying, you know, both of my parents are naturopaths, and I grew up very much in that world and kind of having a tremendous amount of faith in alternative medicine and kind of never, you know, very rarely access the conventional medicine approach aside from, you know, kind of annual checkups at school sort of thing for most of my life. And this has been a really transformative experience for me in terms of kind of coming to understand the power of drugs.
Right.
Truly, which, you know, and it, in part because, you know, anything I'd ever faced before, I could, you know, I would do acupuncture, or I would do an alternative medicine approach and find really great benefit from it. And, you know, for me, you know, diet and nutrition and you know, functional medicine approaches have been absolutely a really important part of the foundation in terms of how I am able to manage and have more function, but they haven't been curative, and they haven't had the kind of, you know, sometimes really profound effects that I've seen in other diseases. And no one knows why that is, and I don't know why. I think the thing that is hard is that it's such an idiosyncratic approach, and it's not a public health solution in the sense that, you know, the people who tend to have access to alternative approaches are folks who can afford them, or people who have the education and the inclination to go out and seek them. And I think that's really problematic for a disease that affects as many people as this does, because in my mind, I'm thinking not how do I get better, but how does everyone get better? And so, you know, then you sort of have to kind of think about if that's true. But there are, you know, really helpful things for alternative medicine. How do you scale that? How do you make it possible for everyone to have access? And that's a much bigger challenge than this disease in particular. But, you know, I think the one thing I would reject is this idea of this is a complex illness. I think we don't know if it is or not. Like, everything is complicated before we can explain it. And it's you know, I think it's profoundly challenging for patients, the fact that we only have alternative approaches, essentially, and everybody has to spend years and years kind of wandering, trying to find the right practitioners to work with, trying to figure out what's going to work for them. And I don't know that it has to be quite that hard. Like, it has to be quite that idiosyncratic how people get better and improve. I think there are ways to better understand the disease and figure out how to match people to the right treatments. And that's just not happening right now. We there are some diseases that we do understand, but we invest in those. And I don't think we can really understand how complex this is or what's really underpinning it until we ask, you know, better questions and invest in finding the answers.
Well, imagine the potency if the two branches of medicine got together and actually collaborated to take the best of both and find ways to uniquely, you know, help people. Like you said, it is this, you know, this illness that affects everybody differently. And
totally. And I think, you know, when it comes to alternative approaches, you know, the quote alternative approaches that people, that help people, they need to be mainstreamed and covered
right.
by insurance and,
right.
And be a treatment option alongside all of the other options.
Right.
So there's, you know, it's hard because, you know, I'm fighting for the scientific understanding and the medical understanding of the mainstream system. And at the same time, that I think that's the minimum in terms of where we're trying to get with this disease. And at the same time, we, you know, there are other conditions, especially chronic autoimmune disease, where even if we have, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in funding and, you know, faster diagnosis, there are many diseases that are much more, quote, accepted, like MS or lupus, and we don't necessarily have great approaches for treating them either. So I am very much aware of, like, how big the problem is, but I also think we need to find out how to get help to people who aren't going to be able to access alternative care.
Well, you know, interesting you bring up this question of access, because I thought about that a lot, you know, after the film. You know, I thought about you and your husband, Omar, and how blessed you two are to have each other, you know, and to have that kind of support and the people that you did focus on. You know, they did have support and they had varying levels of support, and they didn't have support. You know, thinking about the woman in Denmark who was taken from her family. You know, what kind of resources are there for people out there, you know, who are isolated and need access to healthcare, need access to home care, all of that? Do you have any resources that people can connect with?
Yeah, so I think that it is, you know, this is an illness that is really difficult to grapple with under the most ideal circumstances. And in some ways in my film, you are seeing the best case scenarios in terms of people who have spouses or family who support them. You know, even in the case of Karina, who is a young woman who was taken from her home by police in Denmark because of the framing of our illness as a psychological or a psychosomatic one. You know, she did have parents. She does have parents who love her deeply and are fighting for her. And I think what often happens, and I remember I was doing a screening once and someone told me, you know, I worked in a homeless shelter for a number of years and we had, you know, I met people all of the time with this condition. Mm-hmm. And I think because often what happens if you get sick and you don't have the family support, you're not married or partnered, and you can't get on disability because your disability is denied, you know, what happens to you then? And you can't work, right? And so I think people really do slip through the cracks and do end up, you know, in some cases losing their lives because of the lack of support. So I think that that's a really big issue. And in terms of what to do about it, you know, we're really starting to try to come together and provide more support resources. I co-founded an organization called ME Action, and we're running, you know, Facebook groups and also virtual video support groups and conversation groups. And I think what I would say to anybody who is alone and feels alone and is suffering, that there is a whole community out there of people who share your experience and can understand and connect to what you're going through and want to love and support you. And so I would hope that you would come and find us and we can kind of get you connected. But I think for me, it's really been those those friendships and those relationships that have helped to carry me through.
So it's people would go to meaction.org?
Meaction.net.
.net.
Yeah, meaction.net.
Okay, great. You know, I have a dear friend who's suffering with, you know, being in the dark room with, you know, not being able to be touched and really barely eat. And he, too, is blessed to have his family to support him. But, you know, it sounds terrifying in those worst moments. I just wonder how you got through it in those worst moments.
I mean, I had a lot of days where I would, you know, at night I would go to sleep, and when I was asleep, I would dream that I was flying and running up mountains. And I mean, I had the most visual kinetic dreams, and then I would wake up in the morning and still think I was there. And then I would realize where I was. And there were so many days when I would wake up and just look at the ceiling and be disappointed that I was still alive. And every day that I got through the day and felt like I made it, felt like a small triumph, because I didn't want to die.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say, you know, how did I make it? I mean, I think, to be perfectly honest, a big part of it was just being able to get a little better through treatment and have a little more of my life, a little more of my humanity back to hold on to. I think that was a really big part of making it out of that place. I think having that family support and having someone who was there with me and loving me through the experience. And I think I also had to, you know, I think the thing that gave me the most hope, frankly, was other patients. So in the film, there's a young woman named Jessica who lives in Kent, and she in the UK, and she got sick when she was 14 after what they call glandular fever, so mono, a case of mono. And she was in a semi-coma for about 4 years and in a hospital, and then eventually got well enough to come home and spend, you know, the next 6-7 years, so over a decade, bedridden. And she decided once she regained, you know, the ability to stay awake, that she wanted to help other people, other young people living with chronic illnesses and terminal illnesses, to essentially, in a hospital setting, not feel alone. So she started an organization called Cherisar that, you know, among other things, sends these sort of care packages and helps kids to feel special and not so disconnected, because she remembered how isolating it was. And I was in the middle of that period of time when I was in bed 23 hours and 55 minutes a day and could not imagine how I would bear it if I never left my bed again. And I saw this person who had found something inside of herself that allowed her to understand that even in spite of her limited capacity, that she still had something that she could offer. And I don't know how she found that. I think everybody has to find their own way through. But knowing that she did and seeing what she was giving to others gave me the faith that somehow I, if I hung long enough, was going to be able to find a way through. And so I think that's really what it's been. It's been seeing people who, you know, are 10, 20 years into it and have found a way that gave me the hope that I could if I held on. And I'm so glad that I did.
Well, I'm really glad you did too. And I'm so inspired by the film that you made, that you turned it to this, from this diary into this connection with people around the world, and are bringing it to people everywhere. Congratulations, and I really want to thank you for being with us today. I just want to remind people that Unrest will be showing at the Hollywood Theater in Portland this Wednesday, October 4th at 7 p.m., and Jen will be there virtually via Skype after the show to answer your questions. So, again, we've been speaking with Jennifer Brea, director of the film Unrest. Be sure to go to her website, unrest.com, or meaction.net, to connect with others. And thank you so much. You have been listening to Health Watch. This is Ellen Goldsmith, your host. And you can listen to this episode and more episodes of Health Watch online at kboo.org/healthwatch.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Paint and Struggle, Muralism and Radical Politics in Chile, Wednesday, October 4th at 7 p.m. at People's Co-op in Portland. Paint and Struggle, Muralism and Radical Politics in Chile is an evening that will feature a short documentary film and a conversation about the collaboration between students and organized labor in the struggle for free higher education in Chile. Again, that's Paint and Struggle, Muralism and Radical Politics in Chile, Wednesday, October 4th at 7 p.m. at People's Co-op, 3029 Southeast 21st Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices, Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM, the Pacifica Network, and online at madnessradio.net. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Gogo Ekaya Esima. Gogo Ekaya is a traditional healer, a teacher, and a psychiatric survivor. She's a shaman in the Sangoma tradition of South Africa with a private practice based in Southern California. So welcome to Madness Radio, Gogo Ekaya Esima.
Thank you. It's such a blessing to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
It's been great to meet you through the Crazy Wise film that we're both a part of, and we were recently in the Crazy Wise town hall, and people can check out Crazy Wise on the internet.